Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. People who have never heard of cooking have heard of Jacques Pepin. His reach into our psyche of great eating and cooking is simply that deep. He has written more than 24 cookbooks, a personal memoir, and has starred in numerous television cooking shows. His latest, Essential Pepin, comes out this fall on PBS. This week, he'll join WOSU's Chefs in the City crew as the celebrity chef. That show will air Saturday, April 30th at 1 p.m. on WOSU-TV. And he's made time for us today on All Sides. Welcome to the show, Jacques.
Thank you for having me. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. You've said that trends are always changing. A new idea comes about, for example, every time a new idea comes about, for example, diets, and you said the craze of carbohydrates and craze of proteins, and it starts to get confusing, and most people end up going back to eating what they want. Not to suggest that you follow trends, but what is it that you always go back to?
Well, always go back to the freshest possible food, no processed food, the simplest preparation possible, and preferably not too much of it. So that's what happened in Amman. If you have really good food, fresh, you eat with the family around the table, because eating is much more than just a physiological function, you know. It entails many, many other things, and certainly eating with the family, being around the table, is part of a ritual, you know, that is very strong in our family. And if you eat this way, and if you have simple food, I mean, we are going back to the market now. I mean, cooking with the local product and sponsoring the local farmer and all that. My mother and my father were organic farmers. Now, of course, the world did not exist at that time, and they didn't even know they were organic farmers. The point is that 50, 60 years ago, a chemical fertilizer did not exist anyway. And so we use natural, you know, cow manure or whatever we had. We did the garden. So everyone was an organic farmer. So we are just kind of getting back to this a little bit now for the better.
You know, the idea of local food seemed sort of embodied in the first chapter of your memoir, The Apprentice, My Life in the Kitchen, when you tell the story of how you were sent to the country to work as a young child during the war years, because there was food and fresh air on the farms. Tell us about that.
Right, right. This is, you know, this is those type of visceral memories, you know, that you have of a child that will always remain with you. And that's what I tell young chefs, a lot of them, you know, trying to do very fancy stuff. I say, you know, you cannot escape yourself, who you are. And I teach at Boston University, for example, for 28 years. Sometimes I do a menu I call the perfect menu, which is a roast chicken, a boiled potato, and a salad. But all of that has to be done really the right way. In any case, I have 12 students, and I said, don't try to be very imaginative or creating some stuff, because whether you like it or not, you're all different, and I will have 12 different chicken today. One will be overcooked, two or three will be practically perfect, a couple undercooked, a couple burned, whatever, but I know I will have 12 different chicken, because you cannot escape yourself. So you don't have to torture yourself to be different, because you are different. So certainly, when I was a child and during the war, I was sent to a farm because we didn't have much to eat. And my mother took the advantage of the summer vacation, 3 months school summer vacation, to send my brother and I to different farm if she could find a farmer willing to take us. And, you know, we went to keep the cow in the field, but certainly we were exposed to the animal, and certainly to milk and butter and eggs, because the farmer, even though had some rationing during the war, they still produced their own product. And for a city kid like me, you know, it was like heaven, and it was another world that I discovered there.
They say a lot of kids nowadays are so distanced from the source of their food, and you milked the cows that and drank the milk that you got that way.
Yes, this is terrorizing in a way. You know, I mean, when most kids think that a chicken is a rectangular to start with, covered with plastic and doesn't have any feet and doesn't have any head, that's what a chicken look like. Not only were the kids, even quite a number of years ago, already too remote from where the thing grows, but then they went into processed food, And now the kid, you don't even know what's in those packages.
Mm-hmm.
And now what's in those packages is even immaterial. I mean, I've seen little kids choosing the package according to the advertising because they like the blue one or the red one or whatever. So now it's even one step remote more. You know, they choose according to color. I want the red one, blue. One, we don't even know what's in the package, you know. So that's pretty scary. So you have to start, you know, when the kids are small. I have a granddaughter. And actually, next Monday, I'm going to go to the White House to cook on the South Lawn, or the West Lawn, I forgot. But anyway, on a program that the president's wife, I mean, Michelle Obama, is doing. And I'm representing Spoon Across America, which is an organization that you teach kids how to cook and mm-hmm. eat with the family and choose the right thing to eat. And I'm taking my daughter Claudine with me. And my granddaughter, Shori. So the three of us will be cooking there, making crepe and cooking stuff out of the garden, which would be fun. But certainly, going back to my granddaughter, since she was born, she's 7 years old now, she ate whatever we ate, whatever her mother ate. I mean, we put some of it in the food processor, make a puree when she was very baby. Mm-hmm. We didn't even buy any baby food. Stop, you know, chop the lower the seasoning, of course, take the salt out and most of the salt and certainly pepper and stuff like this. But otherwise, she get used to whether you do pasta with garlic or whatever, even so it's in a puree, she get used to that taste in her mouth. And there is no, see, the problem is that I've seen so many times the people who are going to go for a dinner, they do a dinner, they do a roast of veal, let's say, with artichokes or whatever, very mm-hmm. nice. Then the kid come, then they have a special table for the kid to eat earlier, which is not bad, but then the kid are going to a pizza, whatever, hot dog or hamburger, or whatever, and then after, they go to another menu for themselves. Now, you condition a kid like that for the 10 or 12 first year of his life, and after the kid has his first communion or his bar mitzvah, mm-hmm. you say, okay, now you sit at the table, you eat like us. Mm-hmm. Well, the kids, I don't want to eat that stuff. You know, it's not conditioned to this. So you have to do it much earlier than that.
My guest is Chef Jacques Pepin. If you have a question or comment for him, your calls are welcome. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Yes, people say that, well, they haven't developed a palate for that yet, that yes. they haven't matured yet. And you're saying, well, we haven't developed that, but you, it's because they haven't been fed it.
Absolutely. I mean, the point is that you cannot, when you eat at home, home is not a restaurant. You don't give the kid a menu and he chews a la carte. Mm-hmm. You know, when my daughter was small, she always ate what we ate. There was no discussion. There was no, well, today, if we have Brussels sprouts, or string beans or whatever, it was what we had today. We didn't discuss it. We just put it on the table. And I remember Claudine coming back from school from age 5, 6, 7 years old. She said to my wife, you know, Mom, what's for dinner? And my wife said, food. We did eat food. That's what we had for dinner.
I like the old dirt and rocks routine. I think the thing you had though for Jerusalem artichokes. I think as a child that you said,
boy, yes.
if you ever had another one, and you never did.
No, I did actually. It's funny because with Jerusalem artichoke during the war, that's what we had. We didn't have potato, and but of course they were boiled and just boiled like that without anything. And I remember one time my mother came to America many years ago. We went to the market. We were in New York at that time. And she said, oh, those are, you know, Jerusalem artichokes. And I said, they are. She said, oh, wow, can we buy some? I remember during the war, just the smell of it, you know, turned me off. But, of course, we cooked them, and she put some butter in it and some cream or whatever. And, of course, it's much better this way. But still, I cannot reconcile myself with that taste.
You know, we were talking about the local food movement yesterday or earlier, and I was wondering, do you think that's just a passing fancy, or that it's something that here to stay? You know, all things being equal, is it back?
Well, hopefully, it is here to stay because it is a type of revolution that started in the 60s. You know,
mm-hmm.
after the you know, TV dinner of the 50s and all that, 60 people discovered organic gardening and health food store and you know, exercise and all that. Woman liberation was very important. I mean, liberation socially. I remember when I came to this country, if I give a cooking class, I would never had a man in a cooking class, and it wasn't proper or done for a man to don an apron or whatever. And I could look at it now, and I give a cooking class. I have 30 people. I have 20 men, 25 men, mm-hmm. and 5 women. You know. Conversely, this is in the world of cooking school and all that. Conversely, I am dean of study at the French Culinary Institute in New York, and as I say, I teach at Boston University as well. It used to be there 20 years ago that, you know, a new class started, 24 students, there were 2 women and 22 men. Now, I was there last week. Some class had 18, 19 women and 2-3 men. So the women have kind of invaded, if you want, to a certain extent, the world of professional cooking. And conversely, the men have invaded the place of the woman in the home, which was the kitchen and all that, and now cook. So there has been those cross current, you know, and started, as I say, probably in the 60s during women liberation and so forth. So it's another world, and people will tell me, well, no one cook anymore at home. Well, I beg to differ, because when I came to America, I remember the supermarket. I live on 50th and 1st Avenue in New York, right mm-hmm. midtown. And I remember going to the market. I think I relate that in my book, and say, where are the mushrooms? And they say, aisle 5. And that was canned mushroom. Mm-hmm. At that time, you had to go to a specialty store just to get a regular white button mushroom, which now there's probably 8 different types of mushroom in my market here. Now, there was no oil, none of the special oil and vinegar. There was no herb. There was no shallot. There was no leek. There was none of this. There was only one salad. That was iceberg, period. Well, today, I have never seen the supermarket as beautiful as they are today in America. So if the supermarkets are that beautiful and no one cooks, what do they do with the stuff at the end of the week? You know, I mean, someone must be cooking somewhere.
Or just faking it really well.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of food is prepared in the supermarkets now.
It's true. It's mm-hmm. true. And basically, this is the premises that I use when I did fast food my way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, conventionally in a kitchen, you have the prep cook who come in the morning, and that person is going to bone out the chicken and fillet the fish and slice the mushroom and chop the shallots and wash the spinach, wash the salad. I mean, he does your mise en place, so-called, or preparation. Now, by the time I come to the stove, nothing is cooked, but everything is ready for me. So if you order a fish, I take those 2 fillets which are done, in a little skillet, I put a little bit of shallots on top, some sliced mushroom, a dash of white wine, bring it to a boil, cook it 1-2 minutes, finish it with a piece of butter or whatever, and I have that dish done in, 5, 4, 5, 6 minutes, because everything is ready for me. Well, in fast food my way, I decided to do that using the supermarket as a prep cook, and I can do that now. I go to the supermarket, get 2 breasts, skinless, boneless breasts of chicken, pre-washed spinach, pre-sliced mushroom. I have an all-stick skillet at home, and so with a minimal amount of effort, you can do very fresh, very good food without too much time.
We have to take a quick break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Jacques Pepin, and we will talk about his book, More Fast Food My Way, as seen on public television. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. WOSU and Slow Food Columbus present the Chefs in the City 2011 book signing with Chef Jacques Pepin at the North Market this Thursday at 4 p.m. Jacques will sign copies of his book, but you must obtain a virtual ticket to reserve a spot in line. Visit WOSU.org/chefs for virtual tickets and more information. Proceeds from this Chefs in the City event directly benefit children's educational programming on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
It's 48 degrees in downtown Columbus. Showers and thunderstorms today and a high of 65. More rain tonight and a low of 61 degrees. And the rain continues for Wednesday with a high of 65 and then sunny skies on Thursday, a high of 58. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Chef Jacques Pepin. He is going to be the celebrity chef this year for WOSU's Chefs in the City. That show airs Saturday, April 30th at 1 p.m. on WOSU-TV. Jacques Pepin, More Food, Fast Food My Way, that show airs Saturdays at 2:30 p.m. on WOSU-TV. This is your chance. If you have a question for Jacques, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page or go on the web and check out our new website at wosu.org/allsides. I wanted to talk more about fast food, and I was wondering when I was working on some of the recipes this weekend, I thought, you know, this is the sort of stuff you do off the top of your head. How do you deconstruct for a cookbook? How do you break it down? Are you just good at it after 25 cookbooks?
Yes, I don't know. By the way, you say my name perfectly.
Oh, thank you.
I was cooking with my daughter, Claudine. I just came back from Texas yesterday. I was in Buffalo Gap, which is after Abilene, Texas, right in the center of Texas, doing a food and wine festival. And I was cooking on stage with Claudine, as we do occasionally, and often enough, maybe not often enough, but we have a good time. And she was saying something that I never really thought about. She said, when we do a menu, and my father, the first thing he's going to say, well, how long do I have? 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour, whatever. And she said, automatically in his head, he will tell you, we're going to do that recipe, that one, this one, that one. Mm-hmm. We'll start with that. We'll continue by this. He doesn't even have to think about it. Automatically, you know, I see in my head, and after, you know, I've been more than 60 years in the kitchen, and certainly when we do a series, like the last series we taped in October, I have the producer often told me, I have never met anyone in my life who had the memory that you have. Well, it happened that I have no memory. I mean, I don't cook with the memory. I cook some type of process in my head. I'm saying that because the four camera will be in front of the show before we start and say, what are you going to start with? And I have to be very specific. I say, I'm going to put that skillet on B1. B1 is burner 1. So I put that, and then I'll turn around and do this, and then I'll come back, and then I'll turn what's in the skillet, and then I'll go here, and I'll do this. And they say, how can you remember all of that? I don't remember any of this. It's automatic in my head. I start sauteing this, and I know it's going to take a couple of minutes. During that time, I can prepare a bit of that salad, come back, turn it on the other side, do that. It's more of a process of cooking than memory at all, you know. And the same idea in Fast Food My Way, I'm inspired by the supermarket. So I'll go to the supermarket, like I see, for example, now at my supermarket there, they have a beautiful counter of olives. So they have oil-cured olive, calamara, green olive, stuffed olive. Then they have a little bowl of mozzarella. There they have mushroom. They have, you know, all kind of stuff done. And it's all the same price. So I say, see, that's a good idea to do a salad with that. So I'll take a little container and take a few of those mushroom, maybe a couple of different type of olive. The bowl of mozzarella too, and I say, what can I serve that on the first course? So I go by and I see the sliced ham in a beautiful package of honey ham, whatever. So I buy one of those packages. I come home, I put a little more olive oil on my salad and maybe some fresh basil if I have in the garden. Then I take those slices of ham, put them in like martini glass, and they hang over the side and fill them up with that salad in the center, and I have a first course using the stuff from the supermarket. It's nice and fresh. I can, you know, kind of visualize it when I see the food, what I could do with that, and so forth. So it's it's fun, and it's a different way of cooking for me. You know, we try to, in a sense, as a chef, I kind of focus my knowledge of cooking to a specific area of food, And many years ago, for example, I did a food for the Cleveland Clinic for cardiac patients. Mm-hmm. So that was very narrow and focused. Then I wrote, I had a column in the New York Times in the 80s, 90s, for like 10 years, called The Purposeful Cook, which was to emphasize a dinner for six people for the least amount of money. So there the focus was economy. So I was cooking in that in mind. In the fast food, my way then it was to make your life as easy, you know, as simple as possible, using the ingredient of the supermarket and still coming out with some nice, you know, interesting food. And in that technique, which is what probably I'm known the most for, and I did those books in the 70s, early 70s, and they're still in print, these are illustrated manual of cooking technique. So that goes back much farther. That is, if I don't kill the chicken and if I don't pluck it close to it, I eviscerate the chicken and cut it into pieces and so forth. I remember doing those books and going fishing in Long Island to get skate, because to show people how to take the wing out of skate, which is that type of flat fish, you know, because you cannot buy the whole fish. You can only buy the wing, you know. So if people want it, I went fishing even in my pond to get frog, to show you how to skin frog and so forth. So in those books, I start at the beginning what a chef should know, you know, which is at the antipode, you know, at the opposite of what I did in Fast Food My Way. So again, as a chef, it's interesting to kind of focus your knowledge toward one area of food and try to go with it, you know. And, you know, one doesn't prevent the other. I'm saying that, you know, I may spend 3 hours, 4 hours in the kitchen over the weekend doing puff paste, or I'm doing a stock or whatever.
Right.
And I take my time, and then on Tuesday I go shopping and I come home. It's 5 o'clock and I'm tired. I want to eat. I get into the pantry, get a can of beans, you know, and open it and put some olive oil, do something with it, whatever I have around, I will do something like I have in Fast Food My Way, so that the dinner is on the table in 20 minutes or so. So one day you cook this way, another day you cook this way. And everyone does that. I remember my mother, who's still alive now, and who had a restaurant, and someday she would take your time cooking long stuff and very often very simple stuff, you know.
If you'd like to give us a call and speak with Jacques Pepin, 614-292-8513. And Dale from North Columbus, you're on the air with Jacques. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. First, I'd like to say it is clearly an honor to be able to speak to you, sir. I've watched you through my entire life.
Thank you. You must be a young man.
Well, I'm almost 50. But I have a question. First of all, I am a chef. I'm going through some difficulties now, but it's gone from a 550-seat restaurant to being the only one in the kitchen in a 38-seat restaurant.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that was fun. But my question is this. Your comments on basically old school people like me and how they ended up where they were. And the kids today who will go out to these culinary schools and spend, $100,000 for some of these two-year courses to become chefs. Now, I never went to school, but people ask me all the time, what school did you go to? And I said, well, unlike kids today, I was paid to be an apprentice over the years under three master chefs and a number of restaurants, and I didn't need to go to school. I got paid.
Right.
Now, when you were an apprentice, Jacques, you didn't get paid.
No, of course we didn't get paid. And we were told, actually, that we were lucky because the generation before us had to pay to apprentice under such chef. And, you know, apprenticeship didn't entail that we were not allowed to go to the stove for a year even. So apprenticeship was a lot of cleaning the floor and the stove and preparing vegetable and very menial task. But you get speed in it. And, you know, it depends on what age you start that business. Because I was 13 years old, and very often when you are that young, you know, the chef will tell you, do this, do that. You never question. And you shouldn't even question. And if I had said why, you would have said, because I just told you. That was about the end of the explanation. But very often when you are that age, it's fine. That's the way you learn, you know, which by the time you start at 18, 20, you want to know why it works this way and that way. you're already older and the way of learning is different. You know, so certainly I see that in the school in New York at the French Culinary Institute. But I can tell you that we have a six-month program. And in the 6 months, we do 620 hours of cooking or something like this, which is about the same thing they do at the Culinary Institute of America in close to 2 years, because we don't do anything but cooking. We don't do any, I don't know, storeroom or hygiene or stuff like this, because most of the people there, a former doctor, lawyer, accountant, they don't want to do that. They want to learn. What they do after 6 months of cooking, I could never have done after 3 years, even 5 years of apprenticeship, you know. However, I was probably much faster with my knife and moving. So it's a different way of learning, certainly. But I'm sorry I cut you out. You wanted to ask me something, right?
Well, I feel very fortunate because, like you said, before you, they had to pay and you didn't get paid. I was actually paid. I held positions and learned from some of the best in
That's
Columbus.
Good.
And it was the first one was 15 years old, a high-volume family restaurant from a man who was very, very determined to have it his way. And I didn't ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, I got into fine dining, and there was the local, it was the Columbus Chefs Association, actually.
Mm-hmm.
The original, it was created by a master chef, a German, and my chef at this large restaurant was just secretary treasurer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually the fifth member to be inducted into that, and it's gone way, way, way beyond that now. But I really, and a master chef, a Chinese master chef, who was actually, as I understand, an international chef of the year in 72, he was at Brown Derby, and they stole him to open Trader Vic's.
So,
this is a passion. I mean, I love.
Did you have a question for Jacques?
Well, just the difference between old school and new school, and how, and I think he answered the question, which was today it's all structured and the institutions and things like that. But back in the day, it was you were there,
mm-hmm.
You learned from these people, and I feel quite honored that I've had the experience I've had. And again, I'm honored to speak to you, sir, and I'll let you go.
Thank you, Dale.
Surely.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Well, certainly the way of learning is different. As I said, as a child, you know, you go with a chef and you say, yes, chef, and that's what you do. And basically you try to go to another chef and learn from someone else. Now in the school, we cater to the student. They pay a fortune to start with. It goes much faster. But it's America. I mean, the program that we do at the French Culinary Institute with the French program in Paris of the best school, which is sponsored by the government in Paris, and it's a 2 years program. When we brought that program to America, we said we're going to do that in 6 months. They say, are you crazy? It's not possible. Well, it is possible because this is what America is all about. It's different. Now, learning from a school or learning from a chef, it doesn't matter, providing that you learn, and basically by the time you leave the school, now you start working with a chef. And as I tell the student, all you have to say is, yes, chef, and you stay a year, 2 years with someone like this, and you try to see food through the eye and through the conception, through the aesthetic of that chef for 2 years. Then you move to another one and do that for another 2 years, and then to another one. And after 8-10 years this way, you have acquired an enormous amount of knowledge, whether you realize it or not, and then you start to give back that knowledge in your own style. But as I said before, at some point you cannot escape yourself. It's going to be who you are. But at that point, with the knowledge that you have, you try to give back, but you filter it through your sense of aesthetic, your sense of taste. That's when you start creating your own food and your own cooking. But you don't do that like some chefs do after 6 months there in the kitchen. You don't mm-hmm. really know anything at that age, whether you realize it or not. So it does take time to do it. And frankly, to go into that business, you really have to love it, because still, except from some, you know, pretty famous chef and all that who can make a lot of money, most of the people working in most restaurants are really doing very little money and working very long hours. So unless you really love it, and you feel gratified by it, and you love to please people and feed people, unless you have that, and don't do it to, quote, become famous or whatever, mm-hmm. because it may or probably will not happen, you know. So it is still a hard work where you work Saturday, Sunday, 12, 14 hours a day, all the holiday, and don't really make that much money. So.
I was going to wonder, you know, I was wondering with all the new reality shows, you know, like Top Chef and
yes.
all the other ones. I'm a big Top Chef fan myself. Do you think that's sort of changing what people's impressions of being a chef is
yes.
and that it gives people these faults?
Oh, no, without any question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I certainly in the 60s and prior to that and after that, I didn't know one American chef when I came to this country. I shouldn't say no American chef. No white kid with more. I worked for Howard Johnson, and I knew some black kid who worked in the kitchen mm-hmm. with me. But otherwise, the chefs that I knew were German, Swiss, French, Italian, and so forth. There was no white American kid because at that point, any good mother would have wanted her child to marry a doctor, a lawyer, an architect, but certainly not a cook. Now we are genius. It's different. No, I don't know what happened. So, yes, on the social scale, the chef has changed tremendously, and now it's a desirable occupation and full of creativity and so forth. And before, it was not considered this way at all. You know, it was pretty low on the social scale. So it has changed certainly a great deal. And it changed the conception of people. But don't think that because some people have become famous and are doing very well, there is thousands and thousands and thousands of restaurants where the people are just behind the stove cooking, pleasing themselves, pleasing mm-hmm. their customer. But that's making a living, but not much of a great living. You know.
We have to take another break. When we return, we'll get to those calls, so hang in there. And if you want to send us an email, it goes to allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Jacques Pepin, and he'll return with us in just a minute, so hang in there. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
If the Emerald Ash Borer moves into the Schiller Park, the ash trees would likely be doomed, and cutting down the old-growth ash would permanently change light patterns and appearances of the park.
Oh, if these trees go, it's going to be, it'll be really sad, because they're gorgeous. They're huge, they're old, they've been here for years. And this park.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins. And the King Lincoln District was once the cultural and commercial heart of Columbus, Ohio for African Americans. Join us at 11 for a discussion of the past, present, and future of this Columbus neighborhood. That's the second hour of All Sides beginning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU public media.
49 degrees in downtown Columbus, a good chance of rain off and on throughout the day, maybe a thunderstorm as well, and a high of 65 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms tonight, some of those storms could be severe, and a low of 61. Showers and thunderstorms for Wednesday, a high of 65, and then sunshine for Thursday, and a high of 58. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is famed chef Jacques Pepin. He will be appearing with WOSU's Chefs in the City. That show airs on Saturday, April 30th at 1 p.m. on WOSU-TV. He's with us now. If you have a question or comment, now's your chance, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Chuck in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to say it is a singular privilege to have an opportunity to talk with Jeff Pepin. You and my mother have really taught me how to cook, and for that I will always be indebted.
Good, thank you.
Your programs and your books are outstanding, from your autobiography to the masterful work, Complete Techniques. The question I had is, I really enjoyed on one of your fast food series your old friend Jean-Claude, and will he be appearing in any of the future programs?
Yes, actually, I was with him yesterday again. As I said, I came back from Texas, Buffalo Gap, with my daughter Claudine. And Jean-Claude was with me, and he went back to his house. I live in Connecticut, so you can recognize my Yankee draw. But Jean-Claude lived near Albany in upstate New York, or near the Catskill. So he went back home. But the theory that we taped in October, and I taped at KQED, the PBS station in San Francisco, where I have done 12 series of 26 shows in the last 25 years or so. And Claude is usually in the back kitchen helping, and he did about 4 or 5 shows with me, and Claudine did a few shows with me, as well as my granddaughter, for that matter. So, yes, you'll see him around, and we started working together in 1956, which is a long, long time ago, for the French president in France. So that was a long, long... And he's certainly my best friend by far.
Well, I read your autobiography, and I feel I got to know him a little bit, and there were many charming anecdotes, and I would recommend that book. Also, that book contains beautiful recipes.
Yes.
Thank you.
The chicken salad a la Denike is my wife's favorite dish.
Oh, good.
And your Sundays You Go is my standard lamb preparation.
Well, you should try the souffle of my mother, a cheese souffle, which she make without separating the eggs or anything, which you should not work normally. So it's very, very easy to do and quite good.
Well, thank you so much. I do appreciate it. Please keep up
the
good work.
Thank you, Chuck. David from Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Good morning.
Unlike the previous callers, I'm not a chef. I do own a restaurant. I do most of the cooking,
uh-huh.
And I enjoy every minute of it. I'm a lifelong student of food preparation and so forth. And I have one question to the chef.
Uh-huh.
What is your best recommendation of making an open-faced omelet, whether with veggie or without veggies, or with salmon, on a flat grill? The problem I'm having is when you use a ring, you want it to have a nice, perfect round. And mm-hmm. if you use a ring or something, the bottom part get cooked, the top doesn't get cooked. And when you try to flip it, it breaks apart unless you have salmonella or something.
Yes. Well, you start with the best possible eggs that you have, you know, and that's important. And certainly the best possible oil or butter that you can get, whether it's olive oil or butter. But on a flat grill, the technique is different than on a regular omelet, and the technique that we do in America, which is like a country omelet in France, is different than the classic omelet where you really beat the eggs as they cook in a skillet. You shake the pan and shake it with the other hand, and a fork, you shake the mixture so that you get the smallest possible curdle, you know, like a very creamy mixture, and then mm-hmm. you fold it on itself and serve it. So the omelette is very soft, tender, and kind of wet in the center. Here we tend to have larger curd and all that. But as you say, it will tend to cook faster on the bottom, on a griddle too. And that's why I prefer doing it in a skillet. Because in a skillet, even if you put your skillet on a griddle and turn it for a couple of minutes underneath, you get your crust underneath, and you can lift up your skillet and place it under the broiler for another minute too, so you get the equal crystallization or crust on the bottom and on the top, you know. But, okay, I'll go to your restaurant, I'll make an omelet. Okay.
Thank you, David.
I appreciate it. Yeah, it's really, I understand that you can do it in a skillet much better. It's just that we have a couple other dishes that are done in the skillet, and there's no room on the burner.
Uh-huh.
We have 2 flat grills, and we are struggling with making a perfect. I prefer not to fold an omelet. I'd rather have it flat, you know, open.
Flat omelet, okay. Well, but, you know, you can have a very large spatula. You can have one done. I used to use, you know, the bottom of removable pan tart, you know, which is like a round disc, very large.
Mm-hmm.
So something like this, and as soon as your omelet starts crystallization on one side, you slide that underneath and flip it on the other side.
David, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
Anda in Granville, welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. It's nice to speak to Jacques.
Thank you. Hi.
You've had a tremendous career, but I've only found you here in the last year or so, and have really enjoyed watching your shows.
Thank you.
And the one that seems to come on after Charlie Rose, if you know that's late at night, is Julie and Jacques cooking at home.
Right.
And I was curious as to how that show came about. Did you work with Julia for a long time? And I want to tell you, I love the fact that you show so much respect for each other in that and have sort of a repertoire going back and forth between each other and looking at the two different techniques that you both may or may not, you know, have some differences in as you cook.
Right.
So, I'd like to know how did that come about? And obviously she was in the last part of her career, and you were fairly young at that point. So.
Well, it was the mid-90s, and she was 83 or 84, something like that.
Uh-huh.
And I must have been in my late 50s or something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In your prime.
Yeah, I met Julia in 1960. I came to America at the end of 1959.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting point because the food world was extremely small, as I said, and I worked at the Pavillon in New York, which was a great restaurant. And I met a few weeks later Craig Claiborne, who was the food critic and food editor of the New York Times, who came to do a piece on the Pavillon, and the executive chef, Pierre Frenet. And I befriended Craig, and Craig introduced me to Helen McCulley. Some people may remember her. She was the food editor of McCall and House Beautiful. And she spoke with James Beard every day for like 2 hours on the telephone. So within a few weeks, I knew James Beard. And in the spring of 1960, Helen told me, "Oh, I have a manuscript of a book that someone sent me to review here. Can you take a look at it?" And I look at it and I say, "Hey, that looks pretty good, this." And she said, "Well, the woman is coming. She's from California and she's coming next week. So let's cook for her." And she's a very big woman and with a terrible voice. And of course, that was Julia. And at that point, of course, Julia was totally unknown because she hadn't done any television. She hadn't published a book. And she never wrote, you know, for a newspaper or a magazine or whatever, so she wasn't known. But what I'm saying is that within 6-8 months after I was in this country, I knew kind of the trinity of cooking, which was Craig Claiborne, James Beard, and Julia Child. So you can see how small the food world was at that point, which is quite different nowadays. So I always stay friends with Julia, and she lived in Boston. And as I say, I've been teaching at BU for 28 years. So I used to go to BU, and so we go out together either for dinner, lunch, and then after we started doing classes together. And that's what started at some point in the late 80s, maybe, something like that. I said, "Why don't we do a special for PBS?" That was before the Food Channel Network, so the food was more maybe prominent on PBS.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a special for the summer we called Cooking in Concert for the 3-hour special that we taped in front of a big audience there. And it was very, very successful. So a couple of years later, we did another Cooking in Concert, and after decided, why don't we do a series together? So we did, and actually we taped it in her house in Cambridge, you know, in Boston.
Anda?
Yes. And the other thing that has to do more with the upcoming events here, I understand you have a book signing coming up.
Yes, I think I have a couple of book signings, or one or two, I don't really...
You have the schedule time, they haven't told you yet, right?
Uh-huh.
You go to WSU.org and get all of that.
Oh, right. Okay, I need to go online to get the information on that.
Right.
Okay, well, because I'm sitting here with one of your books, and I would love to bring it in and have it signed. So.
Okay, well,
all right.
I'll see you there then.
Okay, thank you so much.
All thank right, you. Thank you very much for the call.
All right, bye-bye.
Yeah, you can go to WSU.org/chefs. And get more information about Chefs in the City. I think there's a few tickets still available. And also about the book signings. Theo in Grandview, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was wondering if the chef notes a big difference in the quality of food ingredients, meat, dairy, vegetables, between Europe and the United States. I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks, Theo.
Well, there are differences, certainly. You know, somehow, food is always a reflection of climatic condition. And if you go on the Mediterranean basin, you know, whether you're in France or whether you're in Italy or in Portugal or in Spain, even in Greece, you're going to grow a lot of, tomato and garlic and basil. So there are similarities to the food there in those countries, in those areas, because of, as I say, the climatic condition. In fact, I think there is more difference between the cooking of Provence in the south of France and the cooking in Alsace or Brittany in the north of France than between the cooking of France and Italy, for example, because it's different in the north of France than it is in the south. So, yes, certainly, wherever you are in the world, even me who go to the wood in the summer and pick up a lot of wild mushroom, I have to say that the wild mushroom are less pungent, have less taste in Connecticut or upstate New York or wherever I go than they have in France or in Italy. Why? I have absolutely no idea. On the other hand, some of the product that we are here, I think, are better than maybe what we have in Europe. But again, it depends. Wherever you are, the cooking itself should be a reflection of whatever grows in the area. Likewise with wine, So very often people in France, certainly, you go to a restaurant and you'll be surprised, a three-star restaurant or, one of the great restaurants, and the wine list is very short because people are going to use or ask for the wine which grows in the area along with the food. There is a certain organic, working together here. There is a symphony, if you want, between what grows with what grows. So, you're not going to go in Burgundy in France and ask for a Bordeaux wine or an Alsace wine. Usually people will look at you. You usually drink what grows there. And it's getting to be more this way here, and that's great. I mean, I think in the U.S., there is only like two states who do not grow wine. And I was in Texas there over the last few days, as I said, and I had great MacPherson and Pleasant Hill and other type of wine from Texas. They have their own characteristic, and they are quite good.
Lisa in Granville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You're on the air with Jacques Pepin.
Well, hi. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi, Jacques. I just wanted to tell you, you have been a hero of mine for like 35 years.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. I used to live in Europe as a young woman, and I used to go to bed with Lavrusca Stromanik.
Oh, boy.
And I used to think my job was to create fabulous dinners for my husband and my friends. But the difference between reading that and knowing how to do everything, I had no idea till your La Technique came out. So it was so pleased to mesh the two. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's me, and I wanted to tell you that grew into a cooking school in Columbus and then a six-course prefixed restaurant and then a big restaurant. But now I have a daughter, and she's very interested in raw and organic.
Uh-huh.
And I'm finding a new challenge to create what I know, and I cook by what's in the refrigerator or what's in the store, just like you described of the program, but with more consciousness in that way.
Yes.
And I wonder, how you address that.
Well, that's a good point. The same thing with my granddaughter and daughter, they are more concerned. But for us, it was always part of the equation. I mean, frankly, when I came to this country, and then after I knew Alice Water, I mean, I had dinner at her place when she opened with James Beard and Marianne Cunningham. So that was in, 74-5 or whatever it was. And when the movement started turning and all of a sudden there was a big article about Alice, getting food directly from the farmer and all that. And everyone was saying, wow, I was thinking of myself with other franchise that I know. I said, what's the big deal? I have never seen it any differently, in Europe. So it was part of the tradition, having a garden and cooking this way, which now, as we said before, is coming back more and more.
Absolutely.
But certainly it is better for you, to have the freshest and the best possible food and follow the season. Seasonal food is always better, which is difficult to do very often because you have the strawberry or raspberry in January, which come from one place of the world to the other. But which is fine too. But usually, trying to follow what's in season. When you have a tomato really out of your garden or a farm next door in full summer, it tastes better than any other tomato that you can have. So
yeah, I agree with you. It's just difficult to keep with the really creative menus when you live in Central Ohio and your local variety is limited. Because
but,
the pasteurization that.
You know,
so now there are some dairies that sell without pasteurization. And so it's interesting now, 35 years later, how the roots, like when you talked about the cooking school, the balance of who's in the classes versus who's the professional chef, how it's all kind of flip-flopped. And I'm waiting for a new dimension to incorporate more locally grown and organic and healthy in a French way.
Mm-hmm.
And it just reminds me of my travels there.
Yes. Well, I remember giving classes in Columbus, in Cleveland, in Cincinnati, I mean, all over Ohio. I used to go to a cooking school in Columbus. Actually, my mother came and gave class there. It was called La Belle Pomme, the beautiful apple. And
Betty Rasmussen.
Yeah, the lady was Betsy Rusbutton,
mm-hmm.
you know, which owned that school.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fun. That probably was in the early 70s or whatever it was, you know, so... So there were always people interested in cooking, you know, and now it's different. As I say, it's more, I don't know, more prestigious now for chef to become chef and all that. But ultimately, as I say, you still work Saturday, Sunday, you still work very long hours, so you go there for the right reason, you know, so...
Jacques Pepin, thanks to Lisa and Granville for that call, and we've just about out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. And I'll see you in a couple of days.
All right. Jacques Pepin will be in Columbus in a few days. If you want to learn more about chefs in the city, go to WOSU.org/chefs. You can learn about how to sign up for the book signings and then see if there's any tickets left for the event. Thanks again to Jacques, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.